Welcome into the Ether, a podcast brought to you by ETHUB, the essential source for Ethereum information. Into the Ether features talks with prominent guests in the community, as well as weekly recaps of the ETHUB newsletter. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ETHUB weekly recap. On these episodes, we discuss the latest news from the Ethereum ecosystem and crypto space as a whole. This week, we are discussing the news from September 16th to September 22nd. Hey, Anthony, you want to walk us through the news?
Hey, Eric, sure. So yeah, what a week, actually. The last week and a little bit has been a lot of talk about ProgPow again, of course. So yeah, we've spoken about this on the podcast before. Obviously, last week we spoke about it and said, you know, the audits had come out and you know, it all looked good on the technical side and we were kind of neutral on it. But I think over the last week and a bit, the narrative has kind of shifted and a lot of people just don't want ProgPow from what I've seen. This is always hard, right? Gauging sentiment on these sorts of things. There are people in the community that are saying that it's only a vocal minority that are against ProgPow. You know, it's the same people all the time, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, of course, there are a bunch of loud voices who have all the Twitter followers and have all the Twitter kind of clout and all the Reddit followings and stuff like that that are against it. But I mean, looking past that and looking at the actual arguments for and against, for me personally, I've kind of gone towards a hard no stance now on ProgPow. I do not think it's worth it. It's so contentious and kind of like, I actually do believe it would have resulted in a chain split if it was to happen, which is just something that we don't need at all right now, especially leading up to the ETH2 launch. We need confidence in Ethereum to remain intact. We also need our governance process to remain intact, whatever it is. Like, I mean, we don't even have a formal governance process in Ethereum, but you know, so far it's worked quite well. I'm always of the belief that unless it's a strict technical upgrade, I don't think that it should be implemented. ProgPow, maybe it's a technical upgrade, like it's argued that it's a technical upgrade, but at the same time, like even if it's technically sound, politically, it's not at all. There's way too much contention and it's not just from like the people who, random people on the internet, it's from well-respected people within the community. And, you know, that's not to say that there isn't well-respected people on the other side as well. Like I know I listened to the last week's Ethereum Core Dev call and there were a lot of people on there that were for ProgPow, right? The core developers see it as technically sound. There's no reason why it shouldn't go in. But I think that they might be blind to the fact that there's a lot of political stuff going on around this right now. It's not just the technical side. And that because it's so contentious, it just doesn't make sense for it to go in. So yeah, there's tons of arguments on both sides. In the newsletter, I linked a couple of resources for people to catch up. There's a Trello board being made by Scott Lewis, Trent Van Epps, and Andrew, which is CyberHokey on Twitter. They're just listing all the points for and against. And there's a Kylo, I think that's how you say it, Kylo dashboard, which basically organizes all of these arguments into a pros and cons view. So definitely go check out that if you want more background on ProgPow and kind of the arguments for and against. But yeah, for now, I guess like my opinion is no, I don't want ProgPow and for a variety of reasons. So definitely a no on that one. But yeah, Eric, I guess like what was your view on this from last week?
Yeah, I guess this is basically the trickiest situation that Ethereum and the community and the network can possibly get into, right? There's no real way to measure sentiment on this stuff. So you could do a coin vote. Everybody knows my opinion on coin votes. I mean, unless you were to get 100% turnout, and even that's weird because like you have whale voting, why should that have more say and all this stuff? But you don't, you get like less than 1% turnout on most of this stuff. Then you have like hash votes. Obviously in this case, you know, miners are going to want this because the majority are still GPUs. You can do like social influence votes, but that we know that's not really worth much either. So it's like, how do you gauge what the community wants? And when it comes to something like this on a network as mature as Ethereum, you know, there's billions of dollars secured on it. You know, it's working, all this stuff. If there's any sense of contention, to me, the default should be no. I've had a lot of good back and forth. I guess you can call them arguments, but I would call them discussions with Nick Johnson, who is a core dev and, you know, developer, creator of the ENS and all this stuff. And, you know, I've basically just been saying, you know, I personally think the job of the core dev should be to seek the option with the least contention, right? They should be looking out for the health and sustainability of the network. You know, he pushed back and said, well, what if we think this is an oncoming risk, all this? But, you know, those are very hard debates to get into. I guess really you kind of just have to break this down as there's four core groups on the Ethereum network. There's the core devs, you know, and these groups obviously cross among one another, but these are kind of like the political factions, I guess I would call in Ethereum. The core devs is one. The second is like the investor and user group. The third are dApp developers or teams, and the fourth are miners. So, you know, kind of who would decide the future of the network, right? That's kind of the interesting debate here. If a fork were to ever happen, you know, I think miners are last on the list. Everyone knows my opinion, and, you know, they provide a service. They're great for the network, but they get paid for their work. And I don't think anyone on the network is really going to follow them as where the future of Ethereum should be. You know, the influence is definitely mixed amongst all four, but you know, it's interesting to think like, it's probably the dApps these days, like the most used dApps and probably Maker. I mean, most of the network, the users are going to follow them. But then, you know, the core devs are extremely important to the future of the network too. So it's just really interesting to think about the politics playing out here. But, you know, I'm for a myriad of reasons, you can go on my Twitter and look. I'm not going to rehash them all now, but I'm also against the idea of ProgPal at this point. You know, my mind, and I think everybody's focus should just be on proof of stake. It's my strong belief pretty much if we don't get to proof of stake, it's this, what we're doing now really isn't worth it in the long run anyway. So I'm definitely not looking for, you know, such a short-term change to possibly create a split in the network. I think really the only thing that can kill Ethereum in the long run at this point is splitting the community and splitting the chain. And we just have to avoid that at all costs.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the ETH2 transition as well. Like I kind of feel the same way. If there wasn't ETH2 on the horizon and ETH1 was the chain that we were kind of upgrading, you know, ProgPal would probably be taken not more seriously, but probably be considered a lot more seriously by the community as like a long-term kind of sustainability effort. But, you know, on the note with ETH2, there is a worry from, I guess, I think it was one of the core devs that brought it up that, you know, the miners could censor the transactions of the ETH2, bridge, basically. So when you stake on the Beacon chain, you burn ETH on the ETH1 side, and then you basically submit a receipt to ETH2, and that reads that that's been burnt, and then you get your ETH2 Ethereum, basically, or your Beacon ETH, essentially. So yeah, the worry was that the miners would revolt and start censoring those transactions and make the transition to ETH2 as painful as possible. I don't know if that would actually happen. I don't think miners are anything but service workers. Like, no, I'm not talking about the people themselves. This isn't a personal thing, but miners as an entity within like a crypto system or a kind of blockchain ecosystem, they're there for profit, right? No one really mines at a loss. Like maybe in the early Bitcoin days, people were mining at a loss or whatever, but like no large scale mining operation is there just for the good of their heart. They're not doing it just to keep the network alive. They're doing it for profit. They're doing it to make money, make gains on their ETH, and they might be stockpiling ETH for ETH2 as well. So they've got a vested interest for ETH2 to succeed too. I know for a fact that there actually is like a lot of miners stockpiling ETH. You can see their addresses on Etherscan. So to say that they would censor and make the transition to ETH2 as painful as possible, I don't really believe that that would happen because they've got a vested interest in seeing ETH2 survive as well. And they also know if they started doing that, then the ETH price would probably crash and their profits would go down. So I just don't think there's any incentive for them to do that. Obviously, if there are actually ASIC miners on the network, their ASICs would become useless if ProgPal was to go forward. So there's that kind of worry as well. But at the same time, if we don't do ProgPal, the ASICs can still be on the network. So why would they revolt? Like, it'll just be the GPU miners that'll revolt. But at the same time, I don't think that's going to happen. It's just the incentives don't make sense. I'm always like one to look at the incentives. Like, I learned that over the last few months from a respected person in the space, a DC investor. He kind of always goes on about, you know, just look at the incentives, and everything he's pretty much said over the last few months with regards to what incentive people have to do, what action has come to play and come out, which is just opened my eyes to a lot of things. So I think that if you kind of look at what's happening on the incentive side, what incentive people have to do something, you'll see the truth. And it's worked quite well for me so far. So definitely look at that. And it goes past ProgPal as well. It goes into things like Ethereum killers, right? Like, I didn't include this in the newsletter, but a bit of a drama on Twitter this week was the fact that You know, Parity, one of the Parity devs basically said that there, a lot of people at Parity aren't really focused on Ethereum right now. They're focused on building Polkadot because Polkadot is their flagship product. And so the Parity Ethereum client will get less attention. It might default to being into maintenance mode, where they just do the minimum necessary upgrades to their client. They don't do any like performance updates, whatever, not like what Geth does. And you probably see that on Twitter from Peter about Geth. But yeah, so their incentive is obviously to build Polkadot. Like that's where most of their mindshare and you know investments going. So you know, Eric, you and I called this months ago. So you know, I wasn't even surprised when I saw this comment. So yeah, I guess like you know, ending my little spiel there is just look at the incentives.
Yeah, for sure. I don't like basing the future of the network on hypotheticals. I don't like this whole, yeah, the miners might attack. Like you said, the incentives don't align there. Also in those, I'm not a fan, like the crypto community really loves to get into this mindset of someone's always going to act maliciously. And especially if the incentives aren't there, they're not going to do it. I mean, why are we just assuming that miners are bad people and they just want to wreck and ruin Ethereum, right? Like most people are good people. They're not going to seek out to destroy something. Like it just doesn't really add up to me at all. And I definitely don't like basing this decision on Progpile there. I think if that ever were to happen, would we have a rough few weeks on the network? Yes, but we would figure out and move on. It's not like they can completely just hinder the network, right? You could deploy Progpile at that time, fork, and take out all the chaos. So we would be fine. Yeah, my favorite comment on the Parity situation was Scott Lewis tweeted. I was actually laughing out loud in real life, as they say, I guess. But he said, yeah, who could have ever seen this coming? It was a white swan event, which is obviously the opposite of a black swan, as in it was like the most obvious, quote unquote, you know, catastrophe that we could have seen. I mean, people should have seen this coming from miles and miles and miles away. And I guess Parity's not on our dialogue today to talk about what we're talking about anyways, but you know, their incentives just don't align with Ethereum at this point. And I kind of wish they would just admit a clean cut. I don't like how they're really just like hanging on and grasping on. My opinion would be they're probably doing that in case, you know, Polkadot doesn't take off and they can come back to Ethereum, but who knows?
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. But yeah, I think the safe bet is that assume Parity's not going to be spending much time on Ethereum and, you know, work around that, which we have already, basically. ETH2 essentially has, like, you know, the 9 independent clients. It's, you know, most of them, I mean, Parity has one they're building as well, but they're not really dedicating much time to it. They weren't at the Interop event. You know, it's just not their first priority, which is fine. You know, we have to work around that. Incentives change. You know, people change what they want to work on. I mean, we even lost Afri like a few months ago, right? For better, you know, for better or worse. And for whatever reason, he also moved on. And now he's doing like a few different things. You know, he's working on, you know, a test net for Ethereum. He's still helping the Ethereum ecosystem, but he's just not, you know, the hard fork coordinator anymore, which is actually a pretty important role. So, yeah, I think that, you know, Parity might have a sour taste as well with regards to Ethereum because of their locked up capital too. Like, you know, the massive amount of ETH that they have locked up on Ethereum that the Ethereum community basically said, no, we're not going to unlock this for you. So there's bad blood there. There's a bit of, you know, there's a lot of resentment from different people in the community. And it's just what happens. Like when a community gets big enough, not everyone's going to be like holistically aligned. We've seen this with Bitcoin. Like, you know, that Bitcoin had a massive split with Bitcoin Cash in, you know, 2017, that's much bigger than anything that's going on in Ethereum right now. Like this Progpile drama, like even if it was to result in a split, it wouldn't be nearly as you know, catastrophic or as kind of like, you know, big deal as that split was, I think, for Bitcoin. Because that actually, like at the time in 2017, that really did shake confidence in Bitcoin. There were a lot of people, except the diehards, of course, but there were a lot of people who actually wondered, you know, is Bitcoin Cash going to flip Bitcoin? Is it going to become the new default? And, you know, it got pretty close at one stage, actually. Like there was a couple of days where the prices were just going whack and like Bitcoin was like completely dumping and Bitcoin Cash was like going up really fast. And, you know, if the core devs decide to, you know, merge Progpile into the clients, and then it's up to the network to decide which fork they want to follow, it could get very ugly like that. So I really do want to avoid that. All right, moving on. So there's just one piece of news that I wanted to talk about this week, mainly because I saw a lot of like misinformation being spread about this. But basically, the Department of Justice in America has brought extortion charges against Stephen Nureyev. Now, if you don't know who Stephen is, I mean, I didn't really either. He's been around the space for quite a while. He's been involved with various projects, and it was claimed that he was involved like really early on with Ethereum. And now, from what I can tell, he was, but for a very brief period of time, not enough time to call him a co-founder. There was stuff saying that he was the architect of the Ethereum ICO and things like that. From what I've seen, that's actually untrue. He didn't really have much to do with Ethereum there. So I just definitely wanted to clear up that kind of FUD there. But in general, this is a pretty crazy story. So basically, he extorted a project for extra ETH, you know, for advising them on their ICO, essentially. I think he wanted 30% of all ETH that they raised paid to him. And yeah, he made these kind of, you know, pretty brutal claims, I think. I can't remember exactly what the threats were, but it was serious enough for the FBI to get involved and for charges to be brought up against him. And yeah, it's just a pretty insane story and something that I think we're going to see maybe more of going forward, you know, as the fallout continues from ICO mania of 2017. We've seen a few different things play out, but I think, you know, the law moves really very slowly, but when they move, you know, pretty strongly. So this is a pretty strong movement by the Department of Justice here.
Yeah, like you said, I'm sure this isn't going to be the last of the crazy stories. I'm sure there'll be books written and movies written someday. I mean, that would mean crypto's probably taking off more. So hopefully that happens someday, I guess. But if some of these wild stories about the ICO craze and all the stuff that happened in the blockchain space in 2016 to 2018. But yeah, this one's wild. I mean, just some pretty nasty accusations here. And to your point, like, I think Coinbase broke the news, and I guess this guy, this goes way back, like basically a year ago, this guy was on TV. I think it was CNBC calling himself a co-founder of Ethereum. And at the time, like Alex Van de Zon and I think Bob Somerville, some of these guys were saying that were involved like early in the Ethereum team were saying, hey, we don't remember this guy at all. Like, why is he calling himself a co-founder? There's this long Reddit thread. A lot of people that were involved in the early team kind of came out and said if they remembered him or not. The most that ever happened kind of said like, oh yeah, I remember he was around. I think he helped on some legal stuff or whatnot. I guess he claims on his website that he's a co-founder still. He might have taken that one down, but he claims that he's like the architect of the Ethereum ICO. And Coinbase, I guess in typical Coinbase fashion, since they just got like, I guess catfished on a story today about the Kick founder, but I'm not sure how much they're checking their facts over there, but they basically just took his bio for fact and in the article called him like the architect of the Ethereum ICO or linked to his bio and didn't refute it or anything. And then of course all the people on Twitter that are anti-Ethereum ran with that and were tweeting, yeah, architect of the Ethereum ICO is arrested on extortion charges. And you know, that just starts this spiral of misinformation that goes everywhere. The Block wrote an article, they called him something better. I think they called him an advisor. I kind of tweeted back to Mike of the Block, Mike Dudas, and asked if they could do some digging and kind of, you know, get up here, like what actually, how he was actually involved in Ethereum. Like that would be a good thing to know, right? Like some people claim he did a little advising on the legal side. Some people claim they don't know who he is. Who knows, right? But it seems very clear that he wasn't actually the architect of the Ethereum ICO.
Yeah, it's always funny when I see Bitcoiners doing that, latching onto something like that, just because they're blinded by their hate for Ethereum. You know, don't trust Verify, only works in Bitcoin land, apparently. All right, moving on from that one, some more, I guess, positive updates from this week. So there's a few project updates that I want to talk about. The Ethereum.org development update. So this is the first development update from, you know, official development update from the Ethereum.org team. And, you know, we're finally getting some actual traction here. So basically, the highlights were full-time web dev has come on board to now work on the website, which is, you know, pretty much a massive step up. For anyone who knows about all the drama about how Ethereum.org hadn't been updated in years and, you know, it got updated and then people weren't happy with the design and, you know, they felt like it needed a lot more happening on it. Well, that's going to be happening from now on. There's going to be a full-time web dev on board, you know, working on it, which should result in a much better website, which is really cool to see. And there's also going to be a translation program. So there is a translation program for the website as well in full swing and a team that's going to be doing that. So yeah, it's really, really cool to see that. You know, in the community, you know, we had that negative reaction to the website, which obviously the Ethereum Foundation has taken on board and said, okay, we need to actually do something about this. You know, Ether was born out of the fact that the Ethereum.org website, or one of the reasons was that the Ethereum.org website was very old and didn't have up-to-date information and kind of misled people because it still looked like it was from, well, it was actually from like 2015, right, back then. And so much has changed over the years and we needed a new site to kind of do that. And that's why we launched ETHUB. And I think at this point, Ethereum.org and ETHUB complement each other quite well, where ETHUB is kind of this independent entity that we run. Oh, well, I mean, we don't really run it. We just have, you know, the community runs the documentation side. We run the podcast and newsletter ourselves. And then there's Ethereum.org, which is kind of more, I guess it's more noob friendly and more, it's obviously an official site and comes up when you search Ethereum and Google and stuff like that. Whereas ETHUB is more for people who want to dive a bit deeper as well. So yeah, I'm actually really excited to see what this, you know, full-time web dev does and how often this gets updated now and, you know, what it looks like into the future, because this website's going to be very important going forward for no other reason other than it's the first result that comes up when you search Ethereum.
Yeah, exactly. That's the biggest pain point, right? Like forever, it hadn't been updated for years. And this is where people are landing to learn about Ethereum. And, you know, obviously you and I are passionate about this subject and educating people in the proper way. And the old website, God, it would still tell you basically how to like launch an ICO and get in trouble with the SEC essentially. So that wasn't a good thing. And then, yeah, earlier this year we saw the relaunch. You know, I don't think anybody would debate, even those working on it, that it's got a long way to go. It's better because it's up to date. It has information. You know, they link to ETHUB a bunch of different places, which is great. But they obviously seem to have bigger visions here now, which is really good. You know, I like to think that maybe ETHUB pushed them a little bit to get this done. It'll be interesting to see kind of how ETHUB and this site play, right? Because, you know, I think we're linked like, I want to say like 10 times or something like that on the Ethereum.org page. Like, you know, I'm curious to see what direction they want to bring it in. Do they want to, you know, how do you create a landing page for Ethereum, right? You kind of got to tackle those four user groups I talked about earlier, right? Like developers, users, investors, miners or validators, core devs or dApp devs, like all these different types of people, even down to like media, right? Like you and I have talked a lot about like helping educate the media and how do we connect people with the right people in the space when we do get people reaching out from mainly the crypto media, but we've even had more mainstream media reach out to us for opinions on Ethereum or connecting us to people. Like this is all the kind of stuff that, you know, a real Ethereum landing page would have. So I'm guessing it's never going to be as detailed, I wouldn't think, as like our documentation page on ETHUB, but I do think they could go a much further step than even, you know, the relaunch they had earlier. I know everyone kind of gripes about the design, but, you know, it'd be good to see, like, just feel good about, like you said, someone Googles Ethereum and lands on this page, just feel good that they're going to be pointed in the right direction.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was like really brought to, you know, everyone's attention when Elon Musk tweeted about Ethereum, right? He literally tweeted the word Ethereum. I'm sure many, many people went to Google and typed that in. And it's like, you know, what is Elon Musk talking about? And they would have gone to the old website. Like the new website, I think, went live 2 days after Elon Musk tweeted about Ethereum, which was kind of crazy timing. But yeah, they would have gone to the old website. They would have seen all this confusing jargon and all this stuff about, you know, old Ethereum, I guess you could call it, or first generation Ethereum, and seen it and be like, okay, I don't understand anything. Goodbye. But now when you launch, when you land on Ethereum.org, there's actually like a highlighted, you know, text here that says completely new to Ethereum. And then you click that and it's like a whole beginner's guide here. It's, you know, quite straightforward. There's a few videos down the bottom for people to watch of Vitalik, you know, and Ben Horowitz explaining what Ethereum is. But it's a lot better than what it was. Now, does it need work? Yeah, of course it does. You can always iterate and improve on these sorts of things. But the fact that we just have that now instead of like the old website is a big step forward, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So fun fact, by the way, if you type what is Ethereum ? Into Google, we're actually, ETHUB's actually on the second page now. So we're moving up in the world.
I don't remember the last time I went to the second page of Google, of Google's results.
Yeah, I know. I was going to mention that. I actually saw a meme about that the other day. It's like any page beyond one just doesn't exist. But hey, we're at the top almost of page two, so we could make it on a page one soon.
All right, moving on. All right, this really cool thing came out of Consensus this week. So Consensus has a new DeFi arm called CodeFi. I guess it's more than just DeFi. It's like a financial arm of Consensus that's focusing on like Ethereum related financial things, from DeFi to open finance to, you know, whatever buzzword you want to call it, I guess. But yeah, so they've come out with this thing called the DeFi score. Now, what this does, it's a methodology to promote transparency and understanding around the risks of various DeFi apps. Now, this is something that was sorely needed, I think, because we've seen a lot of things being advertised as, you know, Compound and Dharma and all these other lending protocols where it's like, hey, earn 10% on your DAI or whatever. And the risks for that aren't called out at all, really, unless you dig, you know, dive kind of deep into it. You don't really know the risks. And there are a lot of risks, of course, right? We saw a couple of weeks ago with Amin posting his Compound article, where it basically says, the risk that you're taking is that Compound is essentially a custodial system because you have they have an admin key that can do all sorts of stuff. And that's very true, right? And then there's also other risks involved, like Oracle risks that we talk about, you know, quite often within the community, that the Oracles are quite centralized. And each project has their own trade-offs and risks, and they're not really decentralized. Like, we've spoken about this in the past, but basically I think one of the only projects in the DeFi space that can actually call themselves DeFi is Uniswap, because it's just completely on-chain, doesn't really use oracles or anything. It doesn't have an admin key, doesn't give a fee to any central party. Like, no one has control over it. It's literally, to take down Uniswap, you would have to take down the Ethereum network, essentially. You know, you can always take down the front end, but Uniswap can be interacted directly on with smart contracts. It doesn't actually have to, you don't have to use Uniswap.io to do that. So yeah, but basically, you know, if you go to the GitHub page for the DeFi score, it breaks down like each component here. So they basically rate it based on smart contract risk, financial risk, and other considerations. So smart contract risk would be if the code is audited, that would get you a tick. If the byte source is verified, that would give you a tick. If it's if your code's formally verified, tick. And if you have a bug bounty program, that would give you a tick. Now, there's a lot of the serious projects actually already do this. Like, I know, for example, at Set, we do all of this sort of stuff. You know, all our code's audited. We actually have a bug bounty program as well. Just a quick plug there for anyone who wants to try and find any bugs. There's, you know, you can earn a bit of money there. But there are actually a lot of other protocols that have this as well. I know 0x, for example. Compound, I think, is in the process of doing this sort of stuff now. Dharma, I think, as well, is doing this, in the process of doing this. But yeah, so basically you get a tick if you do all that. Now, moving on to the financial risk side of things, there's a bunch of, ratios here. So there's a, you know, what's the collateralization ratio? Like, what's the risk if, you know, the collateral was to fall? You know, how many people are going to get liquidated based on the collateralization of it? You know, how much money is backing up the system, all that sort of stuff. And then there's a big one here that I don't see talked about enough, is the liquidity risk here. So a lot of people didn't know, but in Compound, if you're lending, right, say there's a 1 million DAI being lent out and 1 million DAI being borrowed. If that is like that, then no one can pull their money out because there's no DAI in the pool to pull their money out. So you have to actually wait for someone to pay down their debt for you to be able to pull your money out. So that's where the liquidity risk comes in there with Compound. So that was something they wanted to call out. And then some other considerations would be insurance risk. So is it insured by stuff like Nexus Mutual? And I know, Eric, you actually commented that this week on a tweet that the biggest thing in DeFi going forward is going to be insurance. And I completely agree with that. That's a very important point there. And then another massive consideration is regulatory risk. Now, how likely is it for this service to be shut down? And if it is shut down, does the service get shut down altogether, or is it decentralized enough where someone can pick up the slack, or it'll just keep operating? So like Uniswap, if the website was to be shut down and if Hayden was told by, you know, regulators, you need to stop working on this, Uniswap would still keep chugging to call back to a meme there. But yeah, so I guess, like, did you get a chance to look at this, Eric, and, you know, have a play around with it?
I did. Yeah, it's really cool. It's a great idea. I mean, I guess once I saw it, I was surprised that no one has built this yet. So it's good that someone stepped up to the plate and created it. I mean, it's almost like, yeah, like a ratings agency type thing in a way for DeFi. You know, typical rating agencies in traditional finance would like rate the quality of debt in a way. This is kind of like that, right? You're like rating the platform itself. You know, kind of we have this for traditional banks in a way, but it's more like just user reviews and stuff like that. Since they're so highly regulated, like, you would just expect a bank not to go bankrupt because of all the regulations. So it's kind of like we're starting to create, like, this isn't a regulatory framework itself, but we're starting to create tools to give users, you know, much better insights into what they're getting into, which is, I mean, this is vitally important for long-term adoption of DeFi, right? Like if someone pulls up Compound, Maker, Nuo, like, and they've never used DeFi and they have a decent amount of money they want to put in there, most people are going to ask, okay, like, what's the difference? Like, where are the risks at? And now we kind of have these risk scores being created. Really cool. Yeah. And all the different ones they've laid out here. I guess an interesting thing here, too. And like, you and I have talked a bunch in the past kind of about, you know, what's consensus play going to be in DeFi? Like, obviously, they have a couple small ventures there, but where they've really hit their home runs has been around the infrastructure side of things. You know, like MetaMask, Truffle, and Fura, all this stuff. But they've kind of missed the DeFi wave to this point, which is totally fine. I mean, we're just embarking on the beginning of DeFi. It's not even close to like anybody's missed out yet. But I've been kind of curious, you know, what they're working on. And it seems like they're kind of starting here. And it seems, at least it looks like to me on just like conversations on Twitter and this stuff they're starting to put out, that they're starting to get into DeFi a little bit more and more. So it'll be interesting to see what they continue to build out.
Yeah, exactly. Like I've been talking to people about this as well. And yeah, Consensus definitely had a gap there. But I mean, that, you know, they're responsible for powering a lot of DeFi, as you said, on the infrastructure side with, you know, MetaMask, of course, right? And stuff like Infura. So, and Truffle Suite, the development suite to develop a lot of these things. So definitely had the presence in the background, but now they're bringing, you know, their presence more to the foreground and trying to do stuff in this space, which is really cool to see. Like, I'm glad their consensus is moving towards the things that are actually, you know, maybe getting traction. I know in the past, consensus has done a lot of stuff, a lot of kind of moonshots that didn't really pan out, unfortunately, but like, you know, it was a learning experience. And I think, you know, this consensus 2.0 that we're going into now, I think is really positive for the space. I know that, you know, Joe Lubin's really focused on helping ETH2. Like he was consensus, you know, as a whole was a major contributor to the ETH2 interop event. They were kind of responsible for that happening. They have their Pegasus team, which is working, and White Block team, you know, kind of like, which are working on ETH2 and various things around that and various protocol level work. And they have like their enterprise stuff that they're doing with Ethereum, like the Besu client that they're doing with Hyperledger now. So yeah, I think they're coming to the forefront a lot more and not staying in the shadows and being in the background of the infrastructure stuff. You know, everyone obviously knows what MetaMask is, but you know, like Truffle Suite, you only know what that is if you're a developer really. You know, and same with Infura, like unless you know, following a few Bitcoin maximalists who like to talk about Infura being this centralization point, you wouldn't really know what it was.
Yeah, exactly. No, I agree. It seems like they're kind of getting their feet back under them after, you know, a rough 2018, I guess it was. You know, it's great to see them getting back into some of the more, I mean, they've always been in the important things, like we just list everything out, but they also were heavy into a lot of the ICOs and tokens that didn't do well. So, you know, they're obviously still extremely important to the future of Ethereum. So I really like seeing them kind of start to focus on, like you said, ETH2 and DeFi and all this stuff. It's good to see them kind of, you know, it seems at least from an outsider perspective, kind of getting their act back together.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I mean, consensus is what Joe likes to call a decentralized organization. And to be honest, it really does look like that way, because when you look at it, you're like, oh, who's the head here? Like, yeah, Joe Lubin's the founder, but like, is he really the head? And you know, I don't think so. I think everyone has a lot of autonomy within the organization, and they get to do a lot of cool stuff. And that's why I think a lot of stuff didn't really pan out, is because they did just so much on such a large scale, and they did it during, you know, the 2017 year of everything being, you know, oh my god, let's put everything on the blockchain. Like, I think they got swept up in a bit of that too, and you know, so did everyone really. It wasn't just consensus. So I think now that, you know, we're still in the hangover phase of that, and we're still in the emerging kind of, like, I guess, I mean, after today's price dump, it might be a bit weird to say this, but I think like we're still in the innings of a beginning of another kind of bull cycle with crypto in general. So, you know, it's great to see consensus maturing there and doubling down on things that are quite popular now. And I think they'll have success there. All right, last thing I want to talk about was quite big news this week, considering that this company traditionally has seemed to be more Bitcoin maximalist-ish. So basically, BitPay have added support for Ethereum this week, last week, sorry. This is huge. Like, BitPay is a payment processor for crypto. They traditionally did Bitcoin. I don't know if they had done anything else as well in addition to Bitcoin, But now they've added kind of ETH. So this kind of validates the thing that we always talk about, which is ETH being money. This was just hilarious because a couple of days before this was happening, everyone was like memeing ETH is money. And there was all this debate about, you know, is ETH really money? And then BitPay comes out and says, well, you know, you can use ETH to buy things. And then we're just like, well, ETH is money. Yay. But yeah, basically, this will go live very soon. And they're also going to be adding stable coins because now that they support Ethereum, they can support ERC20 tokens. So obviously the natural thing for them to add would be stable coins like DAI and USDC, which is awesome to see as well. So yeah, I guess like, I don't know if you saw it, Eric, you probably did, was there was a tweet back from 2017 from, I think it was either the BitPay CEO or someone high up at BitPay that basically said Ethereum Classic is going to be the Ethereum that they are supporting or whatever, which was, you know, a bit weird. But, you know, it's funny to look back on that now and see how I guess, poorly that aged.
Yeah, exactly. Living through the DAO stuff, I did it on Reddit. I'm so thankful I wasn't on Twitter. It would have just been so miserable to be on there and watch all the Bitcoiners try and make ETH Classic win and all this stuff. So yeah, I did see that tweet and I kind of remember it back in the day and definitely a classic. I mean, obviously, I guess he doesn't think ETH Classic's money. He thinks Ether's money now. So we've won on that front. But this is really good to see. I mean, you know, we get people ask us all the time, can we pay for your merch and like Ether DAI? Like, it's just not that easy to integrate payment solutions with crypto still from the merchant side of things. And, you know, anytime I've really seen it, it's always been Bitcoin because most of the people use BitPay or whatever options are out there. But it's huge for Ether to gain merchant adoption and stuff. I mean, if in stable coins as well, like there's people out there that have crypto that want to spend it on stuff like this. And, you know, if we can get merchants to actually want to accept it, which, you know, BitPay makes it pretty seamless for them. So they should be able to. But, you know, kind of this always brings up those like interesting tax problems too, right? Like this is the same thing with those crypto debit cards. Like when you're spending, like, are you converting it to fiat? I think in BitPay's case is a little safer because you're kind of just the merchant's actually accepting Ether. Whereas like on these crypto debit cards, they're actually converting it and then you're paying the merchant in USD. At least that's how I've understood most of them. So this seems to be a little bit safer if you're in crypto and want to send it and don't have to worry about taxes. I'm going to do my obligatory, that's not tax or financial advice whatsoever, but it definitely makes it more seamless. And I can't even keep up here. I think like the Bitcoin maximalists like hate BitPay now. I don't know if he like the CEO or the team sided with Bitcoin Cash at some point. I can't even keep up with all that drama anymore, but I was noticing that in some of the tweets back and forth after this news.
Yeah, I think that I haven't been a fan of BitPay for a while. I think it's kind of the same thing as Coinbase, just because these companies are supporting things other than Bitcoin. But, you know, I guess like to say that as well, Coinbase has kind of fallen out of favor with a lot of people because they've just been listing all these random assets. And, you know, last week they actually put out a notice saying they're going to list these, you know, all these VC coins as they've come to be known. And I think that's where the lust that goes there. But the same with BitPay, I guess, like, you know, if you're a Bitcoin maximalist, you're hardcore. Bitcoin is the only thing that matters. Everything else is a scam. So it makes sense for you to be kind of against any company that is supporting other things, essentially. All right, moving on. There were some interesting tweets last week. So, on the last podcast, we spoke about ETH's gas metrics and like how the gas usage is at all-time highs and a lot of the gas is being used for more complex transactions, things like that. And, you know, since then, there's been a few more tweet threads being put out by some of our favorite people like Spencer Noon, basically going through different Ethereum metrics and how they're looking quite healthy across the board. Now, you will be listening to this podcast, you would have just witnessed a massive dump in the ETH and Bitcoin prices, but we're going to ignore that and we're going to look at more of the long-term stuff here, which is what we, you know, definitely always like to look at. So yeah, both these threads are linked in the weekly recap. So there's one from Spencer Noon and there's one from Santiment as well. So basically Spencer's tweet thread is 10 tweets going through the, you know, what are the bullish on-chain indicators for Ethereum. So he goes through, transaction fees, of course, and then the gas usage and then the hash rate improving on Ethereum as well, which is actually quite cool to see considering that we're moving towards proof of stake. So we didn't really think that a lot of people would be investing in mining on Ethereum, but it seems that they are. And, you know, we could probably talk about how prog power plays into this as well. Well, I'll digress on that point for now. But basically going through ETH locked in DeFi and how that's going up, how stablecoin usage is going up, active addresses are going up, all this sort of stuff. So that was really cool to see there from Spencer. And then Santiment took it, one step deeper and added a few different metrics here as well. One of the most interesting metrics, I think, was what I mentioned before about how miners actually seem to be accumulating more ETH. So miner balance is actually growing, which means they're dumping less ETH onto the market and holding, more ETH in their treasuries, if you could call it that. That was tweet number 7 on Santiment's tweet thread here. So yeah, I theorized before that might be because they're preparing for proof of stake, and they probably are, but it might be as well that miners may be getting more efficient. So maybe there are a lot of ASIC miners on the network now, and they're more efficient, which means that the profitability is higher for these ASIC miners. So maybe they can afford to stockpile more ETH and don't need to actually use it to cover their costs. So that might be a reason there. But yeah, so I definitely recommend going to check out these tweet threads. We're both huge fans, obviously, of on-chain indicators and on-chain metrics, especially for longer term time frames. It kind of like, I guess I like to refer to it as the heartbeat of a network. It kind of paints a picture of like how healthy the network is. And obviously, as you look at the long term, it becomes a lot clearer. So if you look at like the last year's worth of metrics here, it's a lot better than looking at just the last day. Like looking at daily on-chain metrics is very noisy, because you can have one day where the network did very well due to whatever event, and the next day it does poorly. So averaging it out is what I always like to do. When I'm looking at metrics on CoinMetrics, they have a nice little toggle there where you can average it out based on 7 days, 14 days, 30 days, etc. I kind of like to look at 30 days if I'm going back, very far, or 14 days is quite good as well. So yeah, I mean, I know, Eric, you've been looking into like the on-chain metrics with regards to gas lately a lot as well. But yeah, did you have a chance to look at these threads?
Yeah, I'm a huge nerd when it comes to this stuff. I love diving into the on-chain metrics. I could talk about this stuff for days. Yeah, these were good threads. I mean, Spencer kind of took like all the tweets or data that was out there and kind of put them together. I guess we'd be remiss to say we were all excited. Price was surging. Everyone was putting out these threads about how strong the on-chain fundamentals are. And then today price dove 25-30%. So typical crypto, I guess. Nobody can ever have nice things. But yeah, the most interesting to me is the whole gas thing right now. I mean, miners have increased the gas limit up to 10 million, which is, 25% increase in the network capacity. What's really interesting is, blocks are still full, fees are still pretty high. And the two concerns when it comes to the gas limit are uncle rates and state size. And, all these, I suggest everybody goes and like dives into some of these data sites. So the big ones are like CoinMetrics, EtherScan, EtherChain. So you can look at the gas limit, the uncle rate, and all that stuff on EtherChain. They've got a lot of good data. What's interesting though is, so the uncle rate's flat, and this kind of comes from, it could come from many things, improvements in parity and geth over the last year. It could mean that mining's a bit more centralized or efficient, and propagation times just aren't that high. So uncle rates don't surge as much. But what's super interesting as I was looking today is EtherChain has this cool correlations graph. And even though, gas limit per block is up 25%, the block size actually hasn't gone up. So that'll be an interesting thing to keep an eye on. I put some tweets about, I don't want to dive into the details of why that occurs right now. You can go look at some conversations I had today. But, I think the miners are probably going to increase this even further. I wouldn't be surprised if they push it up to 12 million. Maybe let it sit here for a few weeks, and like you said, get some better data. You probably need at least a few weeks or month or two to really analyze this stuff, but it'll be really interesting to watch, keep an eye on that, because we might see a surge in all these metrics, even further.
Yeah, exactly. If anyone wants to keep up to date on this sort of stuff, I did put out a tweet thread a while ago that goes through all the tools that I use for these sorts of metrics. I don't know how you'd find it. It's actually a while ago now. We'll link it in the show notes. I'll make a note of that. And then you can check out all the websites that we both use to keep track of these things. All right, so moving on. Last thing I wanted to talk about was a amazing post that most of you have probably read already from David Hoffman. So David, I'm a big fan of his work, his writing. I read all of his stuff. He's done a lot of stuff talking about Maker in the past, and you know, now he's moved on to doing a lot more stuff on Ethereum in general. So his latest piece was posted, was published in Camila Russo's The Defiant newsletter. Basically, it's titled Defining Ether as an Asset. So it's a long piece. Don't get me wrong. It goes, I think it's more than a 20-minute read. I think the estimate that I saw, it basically breaks down, you know, defining Ethereum first, like what Ethereum is, like what it's, where it fits in this kind of new stack of the kind of, I guess you call it internet of value, you know, and basically the Ethereum's application layer. Like I'm just scrolling through the blog post now. There's so much to this. There are so many nice graphics here that describe like what Ethereum is, like what are the apps built on top, like what, where is the value going to accrue there? But after he's done defining Ethereum there, he defines Ether the asset. Now, this is something that, you know, you and I talk about a lot, is like, you know, where the value is going to accrue within the Ethereum ecosystem, why ETH is valuable, why ETH is money, why it's a store of value, why it's all this sort of stuff. And basically, David ties this all together into a nice coherent analysis here. So he basically runs through what we mean when we say Ether is, you know, money, and what it means to be what's called a triple point asset as well. So he runs through all that there. I'm not going to run through it now on the podcast. It'll take me too long to talk about it there. But I guess like I highly recommend, very highly recommend you go read this because there's a lot of, like just on a general point of view, there's a lot of FUD right now about Ether as an asset, especially because against Bitcoin, the ratio of ETH to BTC is quite bad at the moment. It's back to like, I think early 2017 levels at this point. So that's really shaking confidence in a lot of people about like why Ether is going to keep accruing value, you know, why it's going to eventually decouple from Bitcoin or, you know, outperform Bitcoin or whatever. This kind of ties it all together and gives you this nice coherent analysis of why value will accrue to Ether. So that's just a general point there, and one reason why I think you should definitely go read this piece like in its entirety. It will take you a little while to read it for sure, but it's well worth it. So definitely go read that. And I think that there's another piece as well from Ryan Sean Adams he put out that's in the newsletter too. That's a compliment, I think, to this piece as well. Yeah, it's definitely in the newsletter. So go check that out as well. It's called, what is it? ETH, the Reserve Asset. So that's from Ryan Sean Adams. So go check that out too. So those two pieces are pretty much the bull case for Ether as an asset. I think after reading that, if you're not convinced that Ether is going to accrue value or become this kind of store of value on Ethereum, then I'm not sure what else you know anyone can say to you to convince you essentially. But yeah, so I'm looking forward to more of David's writing here. He's just really great. I mean, he's just pumping these out. It's crazy. And fun fact about this piece, is actually an extension of his presentation that he gave at Ethereal. So we will link the video to his presentation once the Ethereal Tel Aviv videos are out. So you can actually see it in video form as well if you don't want to read through all of this. But I think reading through it, he added a lot more material here to it as well. So it's definitely a good idea to read it.
Yeah, you just set me up nicely there. And Ryan Sean Adams, he's actually going to be on the podcast tomorrow. So everybody look out for that. I think it's going to be a good one. And I'm sure we're going to talk about why Ether is funny. But back to David's piece. Yeah, this is an excellent piece. Really all I can say and add to what you said is just go read it. Like, it's so meaty. There's so much content there. Like, it would take us a while. We pretty much need a whole episode to cover it. Maybe, you know, someday I'll get him on to talk about it. But yeah, I agree. Like, he's been pumping out great articles for months now. And I feel like every new one he puts out, like, he's mastering the art more and more. He's got some like graphic skills too. He puts together some really interesting like graphics and spends a lot of time on this stuff. So, you know, people should definitely go read this. And like you said, there's so much good content coming out now for like why we think Ether is money, why it can be a store of value, you know, why it will be used as, or is being used, or could be used as money someday. Like, we didn't have this in the past to point people towards. So it's great to see the community kind of, you know, there's education, which are like dry, just documentation. And then there's education, which is like painting a narrative and a story for people of, you know, what the network is about and what the future of the network could be. So I think David does a great job there. So definitely shout out. And he also does a podcast that we should mention, is the POV podcast. So definitely check that out too if you haven't.
Yeah, exactly. I listen to that podcast regularly. It's really great. David's just, yeah, he's just seems to be doing a lot in the Ethereum ecosystem right now. Kind of came out of nowhere, and over the last few months has kind of made a name for himself, which is awesome to see. I always love seeing this sort of stuff, right? Just in general, people coming out of nowhere, getting really involved in the Ethereum ecosystem as non-developers, which is really important, and just making a name for themselves. I think, you know, it's still so early in this kind of space where you can do that with not ease, but you can do it. Like you have a much better chance of becoming someone, you know, well-known or important within the within the Ethereum ecosystem than you would doing it in kind of most other industries, especially because a lot of this stuff happens online. It's a global community. You know, Twitter and Reddit are very popular places. Like I know, you know, David's very active on Twitter. So yeah, I mean, definitely go follow him if you haven't already. His Twitter handle is at trustlessstate, or you can just search his name, David Hoffman. He's a great follow. He's always talking about different things. He's a big fan of Maker, always talks about that, but obviously, you know, very big Ethereum bull. And the funny thing is that the person, his friend that he does the podcast with, is actually a hardcore Bitcoiner. So, you know, their podcast is kind of sold as this thing as like breaking your echo chamber where you get both sides of the story. And I actually feel that when I'm listening to the podcast, and I actually do respect a lot of what his co-host has to say with regards to Bitcoin. It does make a lot of sense, you know, but, you know, definitely go give a listen to one of them and you'll know what I'm talking about essentially. All right, that's it for this week. We went a bit over time again, but I hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you haven't yet, go to ethub.substack.com to subscribe to both the newsletter and podcast. And yeah, as I mentioned before, I will include in the show notes my tweet where you can go look at different on-chain metrics and, you know, see for yourself the health of all of these networks.
Thanks for listening to Into the Ether. You can subscribe to the podcast and newsletter at ethub.substack.com, find our website at ethub.io, and follow us on Twitter at econoar and @sassel0x.